Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
There was a Gallup poll recently that found that 59% of workers, employees that is, felt that most of what they needed to be successful at work, they learned outside of school. But really, that implies that the school should be teaching people to be more work ready. But really, is that perhaps what should be the employer's responsibility, not the school's? That the schools should be designed to prepare people for citizenship, not just being good worker bees, but perhaps activists, questioning authority, as the bumper sticker says? Or, in fact, in an era in which so many jobs, companies are saying, we don't like American workers, we're offshoring them because they're not only cheaper, but offer better workers, should indeed, in an attempt for American schools to help make its students employable when they graduate, should they indeed do some vocational education, if you will, some career-related education? Interesting topic, and at least I think so. And so does my wife think so. She is Dr. Barbara Nemko, and she is on the line with us. I do like to introduce her, as I introduce every guest, with the appropriate bona fides. She has been named recently one of the 40 leading technology superintendents in the nation. She's, of course, previously won Citizen of the Year, Women of the Year for Napa County. She's on the cabinet of the State Superintendent of Schools. Of course, she is the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Welcome to the show, as usual.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So we have, in the past, done something a little innovative that the listeners say they like, which we call a switch sides debate. And so we start with, so where you take one side, then I take the other, and then afterwards we switch so that, quote, the winner of the debate is not who's the better debater, but hopefully that elucidates the issues. So why don't you start, Barb, since I've been talking for a couple of minutes here already, why don't you start by taking the yes side, why you do think it would be a good idea for the schools to replace some of the standard curriculum with teaching the workplace skills that employees claim that they're not getting in schools in need and had to learn it on covering their butts right on the job and scrambling, as frankly we saw our daughter have to do when she graduated Yale Law School and she came out unable to be a lawyer and had to learn it on the job. Why don't you take the yes side?
Okay, well, I think that example is a little bit different because she, in terms of learning to be a lawyer, it may be a little different depending on what branch of law you're in and who you're working for. I mean, there are tweaks, obviously, that you're never going to learn in school. But when we talk about why employers are not hiring our graduates, the things that they say are they're looking for people who are critical thinkers, who have common sense, who are self-starters, who are collaborators. These are the skills that are essential that somehow we didn't teach. We're starting to do a better job now, but we haven't done that. And so if an employer has to tell an employee every single thing that they have to do, or the employee is just sitting around and waiting to get instructions, this is not an employee that you want to have. There are basic skills that everybody needs that I've always wondered why we don't teach. Organizational skills, time management skills, conflict resolution skills, responsibility. Those are things that are so important that you need in every aspect, not just on the job, but particularly on the job. I think when we incorporate these real-world, real-life skills, kids are much more engaged in what they're doing in the curriculum, and they're not saying, when am I ever going to have to use this? And let me give you an example. I was at New Tech High the other day, and kids were presenting to a panel of adult judges, as well as to their peers, a project they had done in rebranding a business in Napa County. So one of them took the Buttercream Bakery, which is an institution in Napa, been here forever, and they did a whole new logo trying to attract a younger generation of customers to the bakery. They had to do research into the bakery when it was started, what logo they've used all these years, why they've used that, who the customers are, who they need to get, all of that. So they learned research skills. They worked as part of a team. They came up with a new logo, and they did a PowerPoint presentation on how they got to the logo, why they chose this, why they think it would work, and then everyone critiqued it. That's the kind of skill that you're really going to need in the real world. And yet it made for a very exciting, fun project. They also had to do not higher math, but they had to do some math to figure out what the budget would be and how much the Buttercream Bakery was making on a daily basis, and whether they were how much they needed to increase their sales, etc. So those kinds of things are critical. And think about when you went to high school. Working alone by opening your social studies book or your English book and reading a chapter and answering questions is a very solitary, very boring activity that, frankly, I did while watching As the World Turns. Working in a group like this and doing a project together and then figuring out how you're going to present it to everybody, that's fun. That makes you want to go to school. And when schools do that kind of thing, then they find attendance goes up, graduation goes up, because if kids are engaged, they're going to learn more. And then one last thing from the individual student's perspective. So many students choose a major based on what they see on television. When Hill Street Blues was popular, everybody was going into law enforcement. When there was I forget the name of the show, but there was a show about lawyers. Everybody wanted to be a lawyer. ER came on. They all wanted to do something in the medical arena. That doesn't mean that that's the best fit for them or that they even really like it. If we do more in terms of career pathways and give kids the opportunity to job shadow for a while and see what the job really is, not what they show you on television, then they don't graduate from college and discover that they don't really like this line of work. And that does happen. And those are among the successful kids. For other kids, they can't see a purpose to going on to higher education because they don't know what they want to do. And they end up taking just a bunch of general courses and dropping out because they don't think it's getting them anywhere. So, yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you. Let's let our listeners know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko with my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, and we're having what we call a switch sides debate, which means that she takes one side for half the debate, and then I take that same side on the other half. And the question we're debating is, there was a Gallup survey that found that 59% of employees said that they ended up needing to learn most of what they needed to be successful on the job outside of school. And the question is, should the schools replace some of the standard curriculum to teach those workplace skills that employers claim are lacking and that employees themselves claim are lacking? And Barbara just took the yes side for now. Now I'm going to take the no side. But first I got to respond to what you had said about Amy, our daughter. It wasn't like Amy just needed to learn the little niche specialty within the law when she became a lawyer. In the end, she came out having to start from the beginning, because from the really learning basic how to be a lawyer, because, in fact, they teach so much theory. And as the anecdote that I've said before on the show, even the dean of the law school at Yale Law School, Anthony Cronson, a friend of his called in the middle of the night and asked the dean of Yale Law School to get him to bail him out of jail. He got arrested for a DUI or something, and the dean had to admit he didn't even know how to do it. So this is not just a matter of technicalities, but right now, certainly the schools are not, whether it be from kindergarten all the way through graduate school, even the elite, maybe especially the elite graduate schools, they are not doing a good job of certainly doing career preparation. Their goal is expressly the opposite. So now I'm going to take this argument that no, even though they don't do that, that in fact that is not the school's job. First of all, nobody could argue that it isn't important in life to be responsible, to have good time management or whatever. But there's no reason that the school curriculum, where there's so much that's important to be taught to get you into college, to succeed as a professional, need to explicitly just teach that. That should be embedded in the curriculum. If, for example, you're teaching the causes of the Peloponnesian War, my favorite example, you still have to time manage in order to prepare that term paper. You have to be somebody who can avoid procrastination. If you're working on a team, you've got to preparing that project. You've got to learn how to do conflict resolution. There's no reason to explicitly teach that, especially since the vast majority of students kind of know that stuff. There is a small percentage of students who don't know, for example, that they need to set an alarm clock to get up, or that they should talk things out rather than fight them. These are kind of obvious, but that doesn't mean the tail should wag the dog, and the school curriculum should abdicate its responsibility of teaching people to be citizens and perhaps even activists for change, instead of creating people who are good, compliant little work doobies. I think for now, I think I'm going to keep it brief, and I'm going to stop there for now. Barb, do you want to take the now? This is the middle of that switch sides debate. Do you want to take the others? I want to say one more thing. You talked about as a model of this making people career ready in the schools, New Tech High School's branding. Well, that's all well and good, but even though you could, I know last night in preparation for the show, you looked at the new Common Core standards that are going to be required in California and in most of the other states. And yes, you can say that some of that meets some of that activity of teaching kids how to brand met the Common Core standards. But really, there are so many of those standards that are nowhere near what would be covered. For example, the very math standards that we talked about the area of a parabola, quadratic equations, geometric theorems. They may learn a little budgeting, but in the end, they are not going to meet most of the Common Core standards if we're doing these nice little practical, let's brand the buttercream bakery. And also, it won't prepare them for college as college exists and is unlikely to change, where almost all students in many majors are required to take, for example, calculus. And learning how to do a budget for the buttercream bakery branding project isn't going to prepare them for calculus. So in the end, aren't you, by being practical, relegating the vast majority of kids who we are now asking or insisting they go to college, aren't we going to relegate them doomed to failure? We already have too low a college graduation rate. So now let's switch.
Okay, before I take the no,
yes.
You added to something I said, so now I'm going to add to something that you said.
Mm-hmm.
I will stipulate that math is the one that you can't really fit into all of this. Whether it's the old-fashioned math or the Common Core math or any kind of math, math exists in this plane all on its own and is primarily, as far as I can see, taught so that we don't rule out kids from having options to go into careers that will require all that math. And that's a whole different debate. But if you look at the Common Core English Language Arts Standards, for example, it says things like, come to discussions prepared, having read and researched material under study, explicitly drawn that preparation by referring to evidence from texts. These are real-world skills. You don't do research for anything, whether it's your college paper or in the real world, by opening the encyclopedia or reading one book. You have to read from multiple texts, and you have to learn how to take notes, and then you have to figure out what are the most important parts of it and put it together into some thesis that you advance. That's what they're trying to do in the Common Core. They were trying to make it more practical, more relevant, more real world.
Okay, so now let's switch around, and what I think I'd like to do now is I will take the yes side and make the argument for why, indeed, the school curriculum should replace some of the school curriculum with this very practical, career-oriented material that we just described, and then you will take the no argument. Fair enough?
Okay.
Okay. Well, those skills that you yourself brought up that are critical, that employees say that they would not have learned in school but nonetheless are critical, like time management, like responsibility, like conflict resolution, also just things like the kind of writing that isn't writing the character analysis in Hamlet, but rather how to write a concise email to somebody. That's something that in almost every workplace, whether you're in a nonprofit or you're a company or you're a government, you've got to know how to write a cogent email to somebody, and it's a different art than the five-paragraph essay or whatever. Those things are valuable not only in the workplace, but, you know, it is so critical for life that it really should be a part of the curriculum. In addition, students are far more. How often have students said, "Why do I need to know this?" Which is shorthand for, "I'm not motivated. I'm not going to do the homework. I'm not going to pay attention, or I'm going to do the least I can do to get by," rather than something that's very important. Whereas if you're teaching those skills like time management, writing emails concisely, responsibility in the context that is practical, they will be more motivated and therefore more likely to learn those things than if we try to teach them those things in the context of writing that term paper on the Peloponnesian Wars or stochastic processes in chemistry or geometric theorems or even Spanish 3, heaven forbid. Also, right now, we are wringing our collective hands as a nation about the fact that American employers are ever more often wanting to hire H-1B visa people. These are not even just offshoring to China and India to save money. These are people who are here in this country, and the law requires them to pay the same as to an H-1B visa person from another country as somebody who's an American. And yet employers are they're fighting for more legislation to expand the number of H-1B visas. And when you speak privately to those employers, many of them do decry the American work ethic, for example. That there's a study I just recently read said that some like 50% of people have spent more than an hour a day looking at March Madness or internet shopping in the last month. That kind of values would make any employer want to cringe. And so should not schools and colleges work hard to get people to develop the kind of work ethics and behaviors and things that, yes, are valuable for employment, but also, of course, valuable for life, merely so that employers are less likely to vote with their feet against the American worker? And now, finally, one other point, and it may seem shallow, but the older I get, the more I believe it's important. Many people are living, struggling day to day, fighting for a decent bit of happiness in their life. We in the sandwich generation, we have parents who are older and we have to take care of them, and that's depressing. We may have children who are adult children who are unable to find jobs. It is not easy to work on your own, even in your own life, to find a good job. How many couples are in divorce? Everything. So life is not so easy or fun in this ever more ratcheted up society. So if we can create a school curriculum that is not just driven and work and these arcane, esoteric, abstract things like trying to understand the intricacies of Shakespeare, but instead something fun, like what you just described, that fascinating project where the kids in groups figured out a new way to create a marketing strategy for that beloved local bakery. Is there not a reason to justify that kind of practical curriculum merely because it's fun? That's my argument for yes. Let's let our listeners know. Listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, we are debating the question of to what extent should schools replace the standard academic pre-college curriculum with more concrete workplace skills. In light of a study, this whole show came about because Barbara had heard about a study that found that 59% of employees felt that most of what they learned in order to be successful in their career, they learned outside of school. So, Barb, now it's your turn. You'll get the last word. You make the no argument for why you think it's a mistake to try to replace some of that school curriculum with that more career-oriented practical stuff.
kids have their whole lives to learn about careers. What they need to be learning in school is basic liberal arts stuff. So they learn about the history of this country. So we're not supposed to be preparing them to be activists. We're supposed to be preparing them to at least understand what came before and make reasonable decisions about the way to move forward, to get values, to understand why people... why most people want to come to the United States, except the people who live here who are always protesting about it. We need to prepare them to be citizens, to know things, and employers can teach them the specifics of what they want to do. We don't need to teach people how to get up to an alarm clock. That should not be the job of the school. That should be the job of the homes and parents and relatives. And even the churches and religious groups can teach those kinds of things, as well as the values of responsibility, for heaven's sakes. Schools need to be teaching the vast body of knowledge and what has come before and where we are today and what we need to know in order to move forward. How to read critically things that have competing points of view. How do you decide who's right when you're reading different points of view or listening to a debate? On what criteria do you base it? That's what schools ought to be teaching, not preparing kids for jobs. Besides, how can you prepare anybody for jobs? We don't even know what the jobs are going to be 10 years from now. There are consistently and constantly new jobs being created, and that's accelerating. Whoever would have thought of the concept of a 3D printer 5 years ago or 8 years ago, and yet that's getting more and more popular. They're talking about 4D printers. That's going to be a whole new set of jobs. So how could we possibly prepare kids for that?
Okay. Dear listeners, so we've tried our best to, obviously, to present both sides of this question. How much, if at all, should the schools replace some of the standard academic curriculum with curriculum that is more related to career and life preparedness? And now we'd like to invite you to weigh in. You can, yes, either say which side you think, you know, you can say one side or the other. No, I don't, life and job readiness should not be the role of the school. You could take an extreme position to say that it absolutely should, or some compromise position, or nuanced position, or a comment, or whatever. Whatever, we do welcome your call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko on the question of to what extent should schools replace some of their academic curriculum with more career and life preparation. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Barb, do you want to, in light of this debate at this point, oh, we've got calls coming right in, so let's not, oh my God, they're all lighting up, so let's not even start talking. It'll just be a moment, and there'll be somebody who will be on the air, and there is. Fantastic. Okay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. It is your turn on the air, and what is your perspective?
Hi, I have to turn down my radio.
Sure, thank you.
My perspective is, I think you're both right for the wrong reason.
Okay.
I'm a lawyer, and I remember my first day on the job and having to write a memo and being shocked to find out that I didn't know how to write.
Right.
And so I had a very academic upbringing. I went to good middle class schools and lots of them for many years, and somehow didn't manage to learn how to write.
Not a surprise.
Write on the job.
Yep.
So first, I think that the schools should do a better job of the things they are doing. Mm. The second thing is, I don't have any practical skills at all. And there have been many times in my life when I wish I had the skill to work on a car or to fix the plumbing or things like that. Sometimes for a job, like when I was in school, when I think of all the years that I was in high school, I don't know how I could be there that long and learn as little as I did.
Okay. Really, Barbara, do you want to comment? I can certainly comment, but I want to give you the first shot, Barb. What do you think?
Well, I very much agree with the caller.
Me too.
Even you mentioned specific things like how to fix things, but I know that my secretary is so much better at organization than I am. That's what she learned when she went to secretarial school.
Mm.
But for heaven's sakes, today, you know, she's not a secretary. She's an administrative assistant. She does so much more mm-hmm. than that. But she has these great skills that I never learned. Nobody taught me that. That should be taught in schools. Today, it's taught if you are in the AVID program. But that's a program only for students who might be first-time college attendees in their family. That should be for everybody.
Great, and I want to add two things. First of all, they do teach you to write, but what they teach you to write very differently. When I was in the doctoral program at Berkeley, I wrote, and I thought I wrote something that was very good, and the professor gave me a bad grade because it wasn't rigorous enough in its writing style. I didn't use enough qualifiers. The predominance of the evidence suggests that one could ascertain truth if one consider the following four factors in these contexts. You know, it creates a writing that is impenetrable except for the very small percentage of human beings who are in academia. So I think they, certainly at the college and graduate level, they teach writing, but they actually teach writing that becomes dysfunctional in the real world. And yes, so many teachers, and I swear this is true, that teachers have told me they avoid K-12 giving writing assignments because it creates a whole class set of papers that they then have to correct, and so they avoid it and they would rather give multiple choice, not because it's in the children's best interest, because they don't feel like correcting 30 papers. So I agree with you completely about the writing and about the practical skills. Here, I'm going to be more academic. The amount of time that it would teach you to do a tune-up, or let alone replace the brakes and all the rest of the myriad things that could go wrong in a car, has too great an opportunity cost. There you'd be taking too much time away from these more universally required skills. There, I believe that should be the job of a specialist, somebody who, after they've mastered these basic life skills and career skills, and yes, activist skills or citizenship skills, then they should go, as in the models that exist in Japan and in Amsterdam and in Germany, a career training program that makes them master repairer persons. Any comment, dear listener?
I agree, except for the fact that the number of hours that I spent in high school mm-hmm. or in school from elementary through high school mm-hmm. and the little bit mm-hmm. of knowledge I got out of that, I think some hours could have been dedicated towards learning how tools work.
Fair point. I think what goes on, part of why we remember so little, is because we suffer from what I call the tyranny of content. There is this curriculum that is so packed with everything, and including the Common Core, but I'm not laying this all at the feet of the Common Core. This California State Standard before is so larded with so much that every instructor, and including a college in a survey course, feels they've got to cover so much ground that nothing penetrates. What penetrates is a deep experiential dive into, if we, for example, took one little micro element of, say, the science curriculum, and we really tried to understand the miracle of birth from the first cell, for how a sperm and egg meet, to the exact physical and chemical process by which mitosis and meiosis occur, I believe, and if they spent 3 months on that, or 3 months on really understanding Hamlet, that there would be far more learning occurring than trying to be so broad and a millimeter deep. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Anyway, I will thank you so much for your excellent call. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What is your perspective on the question of, to what extent should the school curriculum replace some of its academic work with more practical career and life preparation?
Is that me? I'm on the air?
It is.
Okay, I didn't get my name taken. You know, this is a really great discussion. I actually don't know. So I have a doctorate in physics. So I've been through a lot of education. I would lean towards needing that there should be a little more practical stuff in school. I mean, I like the last caller's, perspective.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, math is so important, and I didn't hear a whole of the beginning conversation, but I just saw Edward Frankel on... Colbert Report, I think, mm-hmm. but I don't know if you know him, he's a amazing mathematician at Berkeley who, you know, talks about basically the sexiness of math. And he says, if people haven't learned enough math, it's because I haven't done my job well. So I don't, you know, I really loved Metal Shop. I still have stuff I made in seventh grade. So there's something that's great about, you know, I understand your perspective of the Japanese and the Germans. You know, they have this very specialized technical training afterwards. But there's something good about taking some hours, maybe one quarter, and replacing, you know, some of the English or something with something practical, hands-on. And this stuff matters to me a lot. I have a four-year-old nephew who's going to be going into school, and I have a lot of other nephews and nieces, cousins, kids who are going through. And I don't know the best way to educate, but I really like how you guys switch sides in the discussion. I learned a lot from that.
Good. Well, and I love your call. Let me make a couple of comments. First of all, again, in that spirit of the deep dive, I certainly would want my son or daughter to take one mathematical something that has no practical value whatsoever. Maybe it is, how the hell do we get, why do we care about the quadratic equation? What is the reason for it? How does it get derived? How was it first figured out? Who cared? Really doing a deep dive to understanding that for its own sake to engender an appreciation of learning, knowledge, the mathematical process. I love that. But I would replace most of the math curriculum, like all that stuff on the area, the parabola and the like, with the true foundational understandings of numeracy that affect us in any career and in life, which is a sense of number foundationally, that is knowing in your gut the difference between the tens place and the hundreds place and the thousands place. From there, the art of estimation, which is so critical, and then probability. The understanding of probability. What is the probability and or likelihood that X will occur under these conditions, given these factors? Those are critical mathematical foundational skills that do not require one to be able to graph nonlinear equations. Do you agree with my analysis?
Oh, I totally do. That's really great. You know, I mean, I work in an area where, you know, in particle physics, I don't know if you followed the discussion where people would say, oh, there's a, you know, billionth of a something chance that, you know, the Large Hadron Collider is going to destroy the world, and people got all up in arms, you know, and probability is so important. And we need these things for, you know, climate change discussions. And,
right.
You know, so I totally agree that much more practical in that sense, mathematics and perhaps other areas, but I can't agree with that more. That's great.
We need to understand probability with regard to security, homeland security. We react as with an N of a sample of one. For example, when there's a shoe bomber, we don't consider the probability of that being mitigating against the probable cost benefit of making everybody take their shoes off. We need to be thinking probabilistically, not based on an N of one. And it drives me nuts, frankly, that even national policy is driven more based on these anecdotal, reactive experiences rather than a dispassionate, probabilistic assessment. You buy that?
Completely. And it's the way you put it, you know, numeracy and you know, having innumeracy in the society is so bad. And, you know, sure, I like for people to learn the parabolas and the quadratic equation, but they're not going to remember that 20 years later, you know, most likely.
Or need it.
Right, or need it. There you go. Where they are going to need all these other skills. So, you know, I'm not in charge of designing the standards or anything, so I don't know how, you know, it sounds like a very long, complex federal state process,
right.
But I totally support what you're saying. Some of those, and the deep dive idea is so great, too. You know, for somebody to just really go in and really love what they're doing, you know, and be passionate about it, and whatever that is, without having to just force feed so much junk that they, you know, not everybody wants to learn, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there's something I want to learn. I can't let you go because, you know, I, like probably millions of other people, we keep hearing about these subatomic particles like the Higgs boson and the meson and the quark, and yet we don't, in an era where so many people are starving, we see, you know, you point to the Hadron Accelerator. We are spending billions and billions of dollars to use probably mainly mathematical models to infer the existence of these subatomic particles with absolutely absolutely, and even the scientists themselves who are passionate about it do not claim that it has any significant probability of having any practical implications. It's merely to understand. Can you make the case for why in tight times we should be spending billions of dollars to understand the all of these subatomic particles?
Sure, no, that's a great question, and it depends on how much time you have to discuss this, but I'll do it. I actually help train people who go to Washington, D.C. and talk to legislators.
Wow.
2 weeks ago to talk to legislators and legislative aides about why funding these things are important. And now I actually do astrophysics, so I don't know if you followed, but 2 weeks ago there was this ripples of the Big Bang discussion and I work at Stanford, so Stanford was very involved. So I rest the argument on three pillars. One is the beauty of the science and the intrinsic interest of it, which is great, which I think you probably already get, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's the training of people who go off into industry in other areas. And 90% of people who get PhD, at least who get bachelor's in physics, go off into other areas, into law, programming or technical innovation, entrepreneurship. They do a lot of different things, a lot of data science. And then the third is just actual spin-offs. So the first thing I say, you might actually know this, but a lot of people, do you know what the first website in the Western Hemisphere was, Marty?
Well, I'm sure it was the Department of Defense, I'm guessing. Wasn't it the Department of Defense NIST website or something like that?
Okay, so that's close. So ARPANET, you're right. The Internet, the text-based part, came out of the DoD way back. But the first website in 1991 was the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, part of the space lab that I work at.
Mm.
And the first website in the world was CERN, right, where the LHC.
Right.
And that's because we use a lot of computers that are open security. We use a lot of graphics. We share stuff. It was very natural that Tim Berners-Lee got free rein to go and just do what he wanted. And he came up with this idea. And it's a really interesting history. If you just research, the web on Wikipedia, for example, you'll see this. So a lot of people don't know that aspect. Not to mention particle beam therapies for cancer treatment. And, all electronics ultimately came from quantum mechanics early on. So what I'm saying is, this is a provocative thing I usually leave people with, is I'm not telling you all the stuff we're doing right now won't in 100 or 500 years lead to warp drives or time machines, but I'm not telling you it won't either, right? It's very foundational, and I know there are some people who feel it's disconnected, and I know we do have to make choices in a tight economy, and steward the money well, but ultimately, the percentages are that very large percentages of our economic growth, some people say, well over half, come from, technological R&D at some level. And this is why China and India and other countries are ramping up their STEM education and all the money they spend on these things, right? So, I'll give you one. I think it was either Laguerre.
I'm going to interrupt you. You know what? I'm going to interrupt you here. But I'm going to make one last comment. But doesn't this make us full circle back to probabilities? What is the probability that the $1 billion spent on more particle physics is a wiser use of dollars than, for example, figuring out how to reinvent education so that it really does meet more kids' needs? Isn't that really the question? Isn't it come back down to probabilities?
Well, certainly I don't have the quantum, numbers right in front of me. And I'll tell you that this, particle physics isn't being funded. CERN will be the last big machine. It was a $10 billion machine. The LHC. For a while, unless we can make them cheaper and get what are called higher accelerating gradients. I think both those things are important. I think I'd have to look into it to see where the money should be spent. I think, a lot of our money should be spent differently on the national scale. I know that there's a finite amount of money in the end, and we have to figure out where to spend it. So maybe if it was $1 billion for particle physics or education, if that was the only choice, I might do it. Or maybe it would be a 70-30 split, so I don't know. I certainly will argue that, it's something that Carl Sagan used to say. Sure, we can educate people and we can do all these things. What are we educating them for? Art and science and the amazing things we do, and I don't know if you've seen the New Cosmos, are just some of the, you know, supreme products of humanity. And, like, that's important. You know, intrinsically, it's important that we're able to, you know, look at the first, you know, less than a nanosecond after the Big Bang and say, we know something about that because of some stuff we built in the basement of a physics lab at Stanford. And it's really amazingly beautiful, and art, too, you know. So I guess I would probably leave it there at a very general level. I think they're good questions. I don't always have all the answers, I would say.
But I think we added to a nice exploration of an important topic that at least is very indirectly but related to work and careers, but also to all of our lives. And I am privileged to have had your call and consider you an honored member of the Work with Marty Nemco workforce, to the extent that that phrase is even worthy. Anyway, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you. Take care, Marty.
Barb, you've been listening patiently to all this. Any comments?
No, I think our callers are raising some really important points.
These are great callers. I love it. So let's go right back to the phones. And welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We're talking about the question of, to what extent, if any, should the school curriculum reallocate some of the academic time and academic work to something that is more preparatory for career in life. It is your turn on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Dr. Nemco. This is Cindy Water from the Napa Valley Unified.
Hi, Cindy.
Oh, hi, Cindy.
Hi there. Yes. Well, you know, I'm disturbed by, you know, sort of the either-or aspect of this. I think in the 21st century, we seem to have divided the disciplines. And yet there was a time when they weren't so divided. It wasn't unusual for a scientist to be extremely interested in the arts. In fact, Richard Holmes wrote a book called The Age of Wonder about the Romantic poets and their association with all the extraordinary scientific explorations that were going on at the beginning of the 19th century. What these people had in common, besides knowing each other, where they were both rebels. They were society's rebels. It was really quite interesting. It gave rise to novels like Frankenstein. And I've often thought of some of my students who've gone on to very good universities, postgraduate work, in technical fields, and the best ones also happen to be extremely well-versed in the humanities. They felt that that enriched their perspective on the sciences.
Barbara, you want to comment?
Well, I certainly agree with Cindy. I think that it's a different era, and I think that we do need to provide both of them. I guess my concern is only that we've gone so far in the one direction of so much academics. I'm glad to see that now with Common Core and project-based learning, we are incorporating more real-world stuff into things.
Cindy, I think also our argument was not about science versus literature. Our argument, because both science and literature fall into what we've been, you know, shorthanding the academic kind of courses. We were talking about curriculum that would be explicitly neither, you know, academic science nor academic literature, but those career practical issues like the math that has nothing to do with the Common Core curriculum, which is about estimation and probability. It's about things like teaching conflict resolution and responsibility. So we're not arguing about, you know, the fact that even a technocrat scientist would be wise to have the largest perspective that comes from an understanding of the universe that accrue from literature or philosophy. Does that make sense?
No, I agree. Now, one of the things about the Common Core that I welcomed was the idea of reading and writing across the curriculum, because everyone needs to be able to express himself or herself clearly.
Right.
I know people who graduated in the humanities who are working in technical fields because they are very good writers.
Right.
And I think it's going to be, I think reading and writing across the curriculum is going to be a very tough sell across the country. I know that in Brockton, Massachusetts, a failing school district turned it around. As far as going too far in the academic direction, Dr. Nemco, of course, I salute her for being very outspoken on No Child Left Behind. I would say that she was unique in administration for that, because it has been shown to be a failure, and, you know, it didn't send us in a more academic direction.
Anyway, Cindy, I think we're now getting a little bit too much technically into the weeds for educators, and so I'm going to thank you very much for the call.
One of us on.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what'd you say?
You had to have one teacher on.
That's right.
There is writing being taught in the schools.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
There's not enough writing being taught in the schools.
I agree. And, you know, I made that the comment that a number of teachers say they deliberately don't give writing assignments because that then imposes upon them the burden of correcting sets of 30 papers. Has that at all comported with your experience in talking to any other teachers?
It's a beautiful day, and I'm inside looking out at it with a stack of papers. But
okay.
That is my job. This is what I'm supposed to be doing for my students.
I agree.
And I think that it is something, I think we need to have more reading and more writing in schools.
I agree about that. I think writing
and
is absolutely critical.
That's what makes Cindy a great teacher, because she's inside doing that.
I paid her to say that.
Okay, bye-bye, Cindy.
Thanks a lot for
the call. All right, Barbara, any other comment, or should we go right back to the phones? We'll take one more call.
Back to the phones.
One more call, and then we'll get to summary. And we don't. Okay. I think I'm looking at the clock here. It's already 1:45. So do you want to propose, you know, in light of the calls, in light of our debate, are we taking both sides, do you want to put your stateswoman hat on and make, if you were the czar, if you were, instead of being on the cabinet of the state superintendent of schools, if you were the superintendent, and you could issue an edict instead of having this massive edublob and bureaucracy that would have to be approved by 19 committees, what if you could pass an edict, what would you change, if anything, about the current focus on academics and college preparatory work in the curriculum, K-12?
I would divide high school into career pathways, very broad, generic career pathways, but something that would enable me to take my English class and give it a slant in a direction that kids were innately interested in, rather than just reading stuff because it's great stuff. Most of the stuff that they made me read in English in high school is stuff I'd really rather forget.
Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Actually, it was Anthony Trollope, Barchester Towers.
Okay.
That nearly killed me.
Okay.
And then they turned it into The Palliser's on PBS, and it was a great show, and I wondered, how could this possibly be from that book? So if there is an innate engagement, I think students will learn more deeply, and it will stay with them longer. There are some subjects, as I said earlier, like math, that are much harder to fit into that. And so where you can, you should, but where you can't, that's been a real problem in terms of even schools like New Tech with their math scores on tests. There's a whole other question about how much math we all need
right. When
you think about how most of us really never use it. And even when I used to lock people in rooms and they make them take the math portion of the high school exit exam, the most popular comment I ever got was, oh, come on, I haven't used this in 30, 40, 50 years. Well, therefore, why was it so essential that everybody have to learn it?
The irony is
I
took five-unit statistics courses in graduate school, and I never needed any of what I learned in high school math, almost none of it.
Well, frankly, I didn't need most of what I learned in that college math, because as soon as I went to work, the only thing that they were interested in was what percentage of this is better than the percentage of that given this treatment and that treatment. They didn't want all that statistical analysis.
Right.
That's good if you're going to write for a journal, but most of us don't spend our lives writing for journals.
Well, what I'd like to do is I'm going to propose, if I were the czar, I'm going to take kind of a little bit of a centrist position. It's my nature. But I'm going to make a proposal, and I want to then give you the last word and react to my proposal. First of all, while I am well aware of the advantages of physical education, PE, I love, you know, I've played basketball my whole life. I still hike very rigorously, and I understand it. And it's social benefits, it's physical benefits. You can't do everything. And so in my judgment, the net benefit to humankind and the student body and society as a result would be I would replace much of physical education, maybe not 5 days a week, but right now I think it's one of the few subjects that's mandated. I would get rid of maybe half of PE, and I would instead replace it with a course in high school, or whether it be in elementary school, there aren't specific courses. I would create a very immersive, interactive course in which small businesses or small nonprofits. They would, for a whole semester, create a small business or a small nonprofit. Some would be individual work. Some would be teamwork that would maybe even a simulated government agency. And each time they would have to do all of it. They'd have to hire, buy, market, sell, manage people, manage budgets, deal with government regulations. And embedded in that would be very explicitly, obviously, things like responsibility, organization, teamwork, conflict resolution, etc., sending emails. And so it would all be in a very definitive way. And I know there are many people who would say that PE, we need PE to combat obesity. But there is actually some pretty good data that exercise per se has very little effect on weight, because whatever calorie reduction is lost in intake, you have to walk 35 miles to lose 1 pound, is combated by the fact that your appetite increases in direct proportion to the exercise, and you feel the sense of entitlement. So while, of course, there's probably some benefit in teaching kids to exercise because it is cardiovascularly beneficial, that net-net, we have to make choices. And in my judgment, you know, the kid who is going to sit on the, be a couch potato after school is going to not going to be that much more likely to be physically fit if we require PE 5 days a week rather than three days a week. So I think that the net likely benefit, probabilistic benefit, would be to create that kind of allocating a couple of days a week, couple hours, you know, 1 or 2 hours, 1 hour a day, 2 or 3 days a week, K through 12, to creating these small businesses, nonprofits, and government aid, simulated government nonprofit and businesses. Barbara, I want you to get the last word. What is your reaction?
Well, I'm not taking PE out of the curriculum because too many kids spend too much time as couch potatoes. And I think it's nice to learn how to play these various games. They come up in life in strange places. Volleyball games on the beach, if you've never played volleyball, which, of course, I played for 4 years in high school, not necessarily the best PE experience in the universe. But I think kids should be exposed to a variety of things and get some exercise. But I don't think that's the debate for right now. I think incorporating project-based learning as much as possible can give us the best of all worlds, because it does give kids the relevancy, the engagement, the collaboration, and the practice in public speaking before groups of adults as you present your project. I think those are critical skills. Communication is the most important skill. Nobody ever advanced in the job because they could, off the top of their head, give you the causes of the Industrial Revolution. But if you are a good persuasive speaker and a good reader and a good listener, this is what gets you ahead, and that's got to be incorporated into everything that we do in school.
And I'm glad we've incorporated you into the show, of course,
thank
as usual.
You.
Dr. Barbara Nemco, thanks very much for being my co-conspirator here and fellow debater. I'm glad that a caller liked that idea, that switch sides debate. That's working very well. Anyway, I will look forward to seeing you in a little while, and
okay.
I love you, and bye-bye.
Love you too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
We have just a few minutes left, but I want to make sure that we devote as much as, you know, that period of time to you. If you or someone you love has got a career problem, I do what are called three-minute career makeovers, three-minute workovers. Whether you are a high school dropout or like a caller who is a PhD in particle physics, I usually can help. Nonprofit, for profit, doesn't matter. Whatever the problem, I usually can give you a baby step forward. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, the price is certainly right, 0-415-841-4134. The number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for your calls to come in, I have, in the past couple of weeks, I'm writing a continuing saga for AOL, and that's related to work life. And I was going to, you know, I've been reading a few of the episodes, and some people have said that they like it. And so I'm going to read you the latest episodes. I'm going to continue on. But again, one more time, the phone number at Work with Marty Nemco, if you would like a three-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And actually, it looks like we've got callers on the line. So let's prioritize you over my work-related soap opera. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
You could give me a lot of help, but my reason for calling was to say that I disagreed with a lot of the previous discussion that project-based learning is a lot different from being exposed to something you didn't know existed. and to take math as an example, to watch a new problem unscroll on the blackboard that opens your eyes to something new. Aside from the pure unassigned usefulness of mathematics, if somebody assigns a use for it, it's already a done deal. Where does the newness come in?
The question that many people would raise is it not elitist of us to say, let us enjoy the abstract beauty of the creation of a formula, a mathematical formula, when they can't make change, when they can't estimate probabilities?
I do apologize for interrupting. I know there's people that have serious career issues. I think it's elitist not to.
Okay. I will thank you for that perspective. As I said, I want to devote the rest of this to three-minute workovers, but thank you for your call. Welcome back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. How can I help?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. I'm a leftover from last week's discussion. Would you bother to talk to me?
I'd be pleased to talk with you.
Well, last week you talked about gardens and gardening and seeds
right.
and all of that, and I wanted to tell you that the thing that has been most precious to me is a plant. My mother would be 114 today, but a plant that she left for me is still growing. Mm. And every time I water that plant and look at it, it's a philodendron, which was very popular because it was an indoor plant that grew in the Midwest. I'm from Detroit.
The Swiss cheese plant, there's many philodendrons, but the most common one is something called a Swiss cheese plant, a large thing that's very tropical looking. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm not. This is a small plant that sits on a coffee table.
Okay.
And I've had it ever since she passed away, which was about 30 years ago. And to me, it's the most precious gardening thing I do, because to think of her whenever, it doesn't take a whole garden to make you think of growth and to get pleasure from the beauty of a plant.
There's no question that you talk about growth. That is one of the, if you know, I'm not a particularly spiritual guy in any religious sense, but certainly planting and seeing things grow and mature and then
stay alive.
Or, if you grow a tomato plant, it starts as a seed, and the miracle of growth within 2 months, then it fades and dies. And then, you know, there is this cycle of life that is a useful reminder as well. I'll ask you one little odd question. I'm always trying to tie everything to work, because the show is about work, and that's all right. Is there can you see any connection between growing plants and one's work life?
Oh, yes. I was a teacher for 35 years and very busy all the time, reading specialists, et cetera, and reading papers constantly. And I could stop and take a break and just look at my plant, as simple as that, and feel some kind of renewed energy.
I also like to think in a workplace that is really lushly furnished with plants.
Oh, essential.
Has a number of things. It creates more relaxation. There's actually more oxygenation in the photosynthesis. There's more oxygenation that gets released.
Yes.
And it is just also, again, a reminder as we see plants grow and then senesce perhaps, it provides a sense of perspective that I think is indeed worthy.
Well, to say it in a simple way, it's a mood elevator.
Good point. And on that note, an excellent, concise point, I will thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Bye.
Well, we don't have time for me to read you the next part of my saga. It's going to occur on AOL probably, I'm guessing, next week. But in any case, I really do want to take an extra moment to thank you. Your comments during our debate, Barbara and my debate on this question of how academic we should make the school curriculum, whether it should change, in light of that Gallup poll finding that 59% of employees say they needed to learn most of what they needed to be successful in the job outside of school, it was great, and I really appreciate that. So That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr. I wish she listens so carefully. I've done this show sometimes, and there are people who are, you know, who are running the board and not listening. She's listening extremely carefully, and that is a privilege that she does that, doesn't have to do that. And again, thank you all for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and many how-to books urge us to bring out the best in other people. Alas, there are some people who do things to hurt us. Well, there is a book that teaches us how to protect ourselves. That armor, if you will, is called The 48 Laws of Power. And its author, Robert Greene, who was a guest previously on the show, excellent guest, will be my guest next Sunday. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.